听力课堂，听 class.com.
Exercises 3 and 4. Marcello is talking to Julia about how to behave in England. Listen and make notes.
So, how long is it, Marcello, since you, came over here?
Well, it must be about 7 years now.
And how do you find it?
Oh, good question. I would say that I am used to most things now.
So, how was it at first?
Well, driving was the most difficult thing. I got used to driving on the left quite quickly, but it was other things like, one problem I had was with the horn.
And why was that?
Well, you see, in my part of Italy, we're used to going a beep beep all of the time. It doesn't really mean anything. I found out, though, that English people get very upset if someone, you know...
Sounds their horn.
Exactly. Another thing which was terrifying was when people, you know, pedestrians, just stepped into the road. You know, on the zebra crossings. I just wasn't used to stopping, and I almost ran someone over.
Oh, no. But what about other things?
Well, queuing was a problem too. I mean, it really is the national sport over here. I'm still trying to get used to it. It just seems such a boring thing to do. You know, stand in line for such a long time.
I'm not so sure. I think it can be exhausting having to fight your way onto the bus and things. Anyway, what about the people?
Well, I'd better be careful about what I say. You are very polite, you know, saying please and thank you all of the time. I found this strange at first. All the same, before I lived here, I used to think that the English were very formal. You know, lots of businessmen walking around with bowler hats and umbrellas.
And they're not formal, I mean?
No, I don't think so. Everybody uses first names a lot. In business situations, the Italians are still quite formal, I think. You're lucky as well, because you have only got you. I mean, you don't have to worry about using the formal or the informal form.
Is there anything that you still find difficult?
Apart from the food and the weather, you mean? No, not really. Except, I suppose, about how to greet people, you know, to kiss or not to kiss.
Oh, goodness, yes. It's a minefield.
Exercise 10. Listen and find out if you are right. 1.
Does this bus go to town?
I don't think so.
2.
Do you speak English?
Yes, I do.
3.
You're German, aren't you?
Actually, I'm Swiss.
4.
Is it okay if I smoke?
I'd rather you didn't.
5.
Have you got a pen I could borrow?
I'm afraid not.
6.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
7.
Would you like a cigarette?
No, thanks.
8.
Would you like to come to the cinema tomorrow?
I'm afraid I'm busy. What a pity.
9.
Can I make a phone call?
Yes, of course.
Exercise 5. Joan Tull talks about why she wants to do VSO. Listen and answer the questions in your student's book.
I always wanted to do something that was about helping people and feeling that what you did was important to people and that it mattered. So that's the basic reason why I'll be going to do VSO, I think.
I'm quite looking forward to going to a completely different environment that's different on all sorts of levels, in terms of the culture, in terms of the standard of living. I'll be quite interested to just find out how a whole different set of people live.
Exercise 6. Joan describes what she'll be doing.
I'll be going to Zimbabwe to quite a large village school, and I'll be teaching English to
16-year-olds up to O-level, and I think I'll be a form teacher to 12 and 13-year-olds. I'll be staying for 2 years minimum, and there's a possibility of having that extended to 3 or 4 years.
Exercise 8. Joan talks about her life in London and her future in Zimbabwe. Listen and check your answers.
I'll have to get used to a whole series, a whole raft of different working conditions. I'm used to working in quite a high-tech sort of industry that's got lots of machinery and everything, and I'm going to be going to a place that has no machinery apart from a typewriter, has no electricity at all, no photocopiers, all the things that you take for granted. They just won't be there anymore, so I'm going to have to get used to that sort of thing, really. I'll be staying near the school, which is called Kawandera, in quite a small village. It's amid sort of farmers, generally. It's quite near to a sort of small town, but it's quite rural itself. And I'll be staying in a teacher's house, living with 2 or 3 other Zimbabwean teachers. I have to get used to not having the variety of different foods that you have here, like 20 different varieties of breakfast cereal and all the food that you could possibly want and can think of you can have here, and the range of food there is much smaller. I have to get used to getting water from a borehole, not having electricity, which means gas lamps in the evening, which means the difficulty of preparing for the next day's lessons in poor light, different ways of getting your clothes washed, how you make your own entertainment in the evenings, because I'm used to coming home and watching television and, you know, phoning your friends and listening to music and that sort of thing. And there'll be sort of quite big differences like that that I'll have to get used to. I'll miss shopping for clothes in my favourite clothes stores, and I'll miss seeing my friends after work and going to the cinema and going to a club, going to parties, an endless list of things that I can think of that I do without thinking about it, really, that I'm going to miss.
Exercise 9. Joan talks about things it will be difficult to get used to.
I think there'll be quite a lot of cultural differences, and those are going to be the most difficult things to get used to, because physical things I think you can adapt to really quickly. I think a different way of looking at the role of women in society is going to be quite difficult, because I'm used to saying exactly what I think about everything, and I'm just going to have to learn to keep quiet about things. But the problem with that is that I can see why you have to do that, but then if quite a big part of yourself is to kind of not like injustices or whatever it is and to say what you think, then how much is it that you're kind of changing yourself as a person and as a personality? And maybe I'll get there and I'll find that, you know, it simply is not a problem at all.
Exercise 2. Listen to Lucy's presentation and make notes.
Good evening, everybody. I'm going to tell you something about my travels to the Far East. As you can imagine, I saw a lot of festivals, but the one I'm going to tell you about is the Dragon Boat Festival, which takes place in the middle of the summer in Hong Kong. It's an absolutely marvellous setting for the event. There are other races throughout China, but this one attracts the most foreign spectators. First of all, before I carry on, I should say a few words about dragons. They are very important symbols in Chinese myth and legend. Once upon a time, people used to believe that rain was made by dragons fighting up in the skies. Anyway, going back to the festival, it's also known as Poets' Day. Let me explain how it got this name. Long ago, there was a wise man and poet called Ku Yuan, who threw himself into the Milo River as a protest against corruption. People went out in boats to save him, but he drowned. Fishermen threw rice into the river so sharks wouldn't eat his body. Afterwards, his ghost came and told the fisherman that the best way to scare away bad spirits was to wrap up little parcels of rice in silk. Nowadays, in memory of the poet, people eat special rice dumplings wrapped up in leaves. Returning to the festival itself, the event that attracts so many visitors is the dragon boat race. Dragon boats are rowing boats with a carved dragon's head on the front. Each boat has two lines of rowers who paddle furiously while someone beats time on an enormous drum. Oh, incidentally, the race is taken very seriously. It's an international event, too. Although most teams come from the region, some are from as far apart as France, South Africa, and New Zealand. Actually, there are so many that there are lots of heats, you know, qualifying races, before a team can get to the final. When I went, the men's final was won by an Indonesian team, while a team from Canada won the women's. It was an exciting climax to the event. In fact, I cheered and shouted so much that I lost my voice. If you'd like to gather round, I've got some photos here which will give you a better idea of what actually goes on. I've also brought some rice dumplings in for everyone to try, so help yourselves. Are there any questions?
Exercise 2. Listen and find out if your answers to exercise 1 were right. A.
The Ring of Stones is Stonehenge in the south of England. It was built around 2000 BC. Some people believe that Stonehenge was a kind of giant observatory, and that it was used for astronomy and for astronomical calculations. There are two amazing things about it. The first is the weight of the stones, and the fact that they were moved such distances before the invention of the wheel. They were probably pulled on sledges. The second thing is how a primitive people on the edge of Europe managed to accomplish such work, which required advanced engineering skills.
B.
Exactly why the pyramids were built, and their positioning, remains a mystery. We know that the tombs were packed with treasure to help the pharaoh in his afterlife. Most of the tombs, of course, have been robbed, and their treasure stolen. But recently, archaeologists have come across some hieroglyphics which were every bit as valuable. They found out new information which suggests that the pyramids may have been built as launching pads for the dead pharaohs to project their souls to the stars. The pyramids were arranged to represent the position of some of the stars in the sky. The River Nile was the earthly equivalent of the Milky Way.
C.
This picture shows an impression of Atlantis from a film. Atlantis was supposed to be an island with a rich and civilized culture, which then simply disappeared one day. It just vanished. There are lots of theories about where Atlantis was and what happened to it. The most likely explanation is that Atlantis was a volcanic island, and in around 1450 BC, the volcano erupted one day, leaving just the crater sticking up out of the sea. Nowadays, all that remains, according to some people, is the island of Thera, north of Crete.
Exercises 7 and 8. Rick Turner talks about the discovery of Lindoman. Listen and answer the questions in your student's book.
The story begins in the Peak Depot, which is just off the site where we're standing, where the men one day found what turned out to be a well-preserved human foot. I got to hear about this as the local archaeologist responsible for the area and came out the next day out onto the bog just behind where we're standing and found what turned out to be the rest of Lindo Man. We came here and what we excavated was the peat in which the body lay. We didn't at that stage want to uncover the body, so when we came here we actually lifted a block of peat and we weren't exactly certain of what might have been in there. We could see exactly what he looked like, the fact he was bearded, the fact his hair was neatly trimmed, perhaps with a form of shears rather than scissors. It was before scissors were invented. We found evidence of the stomach, and the remains in the stomach tells us what he might have eaten, for his last meal or his last two meals, so he could reconstruct that very accurately. The evidence for how Lindo Man died is very clear, and you can reconstruct the events quite closely. What seems to have happened first is that from the two fractures that we found on the top of the head, it seems that he might have been hit by an axe or a weapon of some sort that certainly made him unconscious and perhaps killed him. Not happy with that, the people responsible then tied a strong cord around the neck, tied at the back of the neck, perhaps inserted a stick through the cord, twisted the stick until the neck was broken and the breathing cut off. Finally, from the evidence of a cut underneath the neck, we think he might have been bled, and the blood would have poured forth from the body onto the ground. So we have a very complicated and perhaps ritualistic death. From all the evidence we've been able to gather, from the scientific analyses and the detailed tests and the studies we've made, we can begin to build a picture of who Lindo Man was, how he lived, and how he died. He was a man, we know that for certain. He was perhaps 25, likely to be of medium build. He must have been someone who didn't work in the fields to the end of his life. He had beautifully smooth fingernails. He might have been a bard, or perhaps a warrior, or even a priest. First of all, he must decide what date he might have died. We think it's most likely that he was Iron Age or died just after the Romans had invaded. If so, he was Celtic. He was a member of a Celtic tribe who would have lived here in Cheshire at the time. We can reconstruct his appearance very accurately. We have a face from the past that we can look at and see that perhaps the past is not so far from our present time, that he looks much as you and I do, and he would have been walking here around 2,000 years ago. He almost certainly comes from the local area. Why he came to be in the bog is the mystery that everyone can speculate about.
Exercise 9. Listen and check your answers. 1. We stayed in a famous haunted house last year, which was in the middle of nowhere. 2.
I know a man who believes he can contact spirits.
3.
That's the woman whose parents are spiritualists.
4.
The article about Coral Polga, which I told you about yesterday, came from a very interesting book.
Exercise 10. Listen and answer the questions in your student's book.
2 summers ago, when I'd just left school, I managed to get a job for about 6 weeks over the summer on an archaeological dig.
Where was it? Greece or somewhere like that?
No, nowhere so romantic. It was up near Pistoia, an Etruscan site. It's in the middle of nowhere. There were about 15 of us altogether, all camping out in tents by the dig. Anyway, at the end of the day, this happened every evening, we all had a meal together and chatted and things. Nothing else to do, you see. Well, one evening, someone, I think it was Monica, had the bright idea that we should hold some kind of seance.
What? All joining hands and things?
Well, not quite. We had a glass and letters on the table. You know, the kind of thing.
Where you touch it with your fingertips and it moves around.
Right. So, there were 6 of us. We did all the usual thing. Is there anybody there? And to our amazement, there was. We asked the spirit to spell its name. So anyway, the glass went up and down and spelt out the name Charmian.
That's odd. It's an unusual name, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a girl's name. Well, anyway, at this, one of the guys, called Kerr, he turned as white as a sheet. And when we asked the spirit who it wanted to speak to, we should have stopped at that point, it started to spell out K-U-R, and before it could get to T, Kurt stood up and ran out of the tent. He totally freaked out. I was scared stiff, absolutely petrified by this time.
Wow, and did you run after him?
Sure, But on top of everything, it was a really misty night. There was hardly any moon, and all the trenches, you know, the holes we'd dug, were full of mist. It was really spooky, like something out of a horror movie. We got torches and eventually found him at the bottom of a trench, shivering, with his teeth chattering, looking out of his mind.
Gosh! So who was this Charmian, then?
He just wouldn't say. The next day, he just packed his things and left.
Exercise 3. Bruce makes predictions about the world in 2025. Listen and answer the questions in your student's book.
I think that Europe has a great deal to teach the world, possibly. Probably more so at this point in time than the United States or even the East Asian groups. Europe has been a source of a lot of trouble in the 20th century, and it's nationalist trouble and political trouble. If the Europeans can learn to overcome their own tribalism, then perhaps the rest of the world can learn. On the other hand, if the Europeans cannot do this, then I foresee very great trouble, probably another world war, perhaps more savage than the earlier ones, and that's not a pleasant prospect. But I don't believe that will, in fact, happen. I think the Europeans will have their open borders. I think they will have a one European currency, and I think they have a good chance of becoming the single most powerful trading bloc of the three I see coming.
Exercise 4. Listen to more of Bruce's predictions. Are the statements in your student's book true or false?
I believe we will have stopped wasting so many of our resources. I believe we will have installed much more recycling. I believe that our industries will have become much cleaner. They will have been redesigned from top to bottom to save energy, to save resources, to stop pollution. I believe we will take much more care about what we put into our environment in the way of chemicals and toxins. I believe also that our eating habits will change drastically. We will be eating material in 2025 that would be basically unrecognizable to anyone today. I think there will be a great vogue for artificial foods because they're cheap to make. I believe practices like slaughtering livestock for food will still be around, but they will have been abandoned in great extent, not because of moral reasons, but basically for financial reasons. There's simply not going to be room for enormous herds of cattle.
Exercise 5. Bruce summarizes the progress of the human race. Listen and complete the text in your student's book.
We will have become more advanced, but we will not have become any more moral. I think we will still see the same hypocrisy, the same greed, the same basic animal traits that have always propelled humanity. But on the other hand, I don't believe we will have become any worse. And perhaps our increasing knowledge may bring us a little bit more wisdom.
Exercise 5. Listen to these pairs of sentences from Exercise 4. Which words are stressed? 1.
Not only did he name the ship Titan, but he predicted where the Titanic would sink.
He named the ship Titan, and also predicted where the Titanic would sink.
2.
No sooner did he discover this than he rushed out and placed bets on both of them.
As soon as he discovered this, he rushed out and placed bets on both of them.
3.
Never before had there been such a dreadful accident.
There'd never been such a dreadful accident.
4.
Hardly had he fallen asleep when he had a terrible dream.
A few minutes after he fell asleep, he had a terrible dream.
Exercise 7. Listen and check your answers to Exercise 6. 1.
No sooner had Mariano had the strange dream than he left the bank.
2. Never before had they had such a strange feeling. 3.
The problem was that not only did I lie awake for hours, but I also had nightmares.
4.
Hardly had we fallen asleep when the alarm went off.
5.
Never before had a premonition saved so many lives.
Exercise 6. Listen to this talk and answer the questions in your student's book.
I think you should let me into the bunker. After all, everyone's going to be sad and miserable, and we'll all get terribly depressed. We'll need to stay optimistic and cheerful. Even though I can't cook or make things, I can keep everyone happy by telling them jokes and organizing sketches. In difficult situations, morale is very important. The last person we want with us is a politician or a soldier. They're the people who got us into this mess in the first place.
Exercise 3. Juliet describes a trick her memory played on her. Listen and answer the questions in your student's book.
It's strange the tricks that memory can play on you. I remember once going to a department store one dark, miserable winter's evening and being suddenly overcome by a feeling of happiness and excitement. For some reason or other, I started to think of the holidays I used to have in the south of France as a child, and the marvellous times I'd had there. We'd go down every summer, but what surprised me was the strength of the sensation. It did surprise me, really. I mean, nothing like that had ever happened before. And then a few minutes later, I understood what had caused it. It was the scent of jasmine, you see, from the perfume counter. It's a smell I'll always associate with the house we always rented. There was jasmine there, you see, and its strong, sweet perfume would fill the garden. Anyway, without being conscious of it, it had triggered a whole lot of memories. You know, it's strange that when people talk about the senses, they think mainly about sight and hearing and touch. They say taste and smell aren't that important, but I think taste and smell are really underrated.
Exercise 9. Listen to the poem Piano by D.H. Lawrence.
Softly in the dusk, a woman is singing to me, taking me back down the vista of years, till I see a child sitting under the piano in the boom of the tingling strings, and pressing the small poised feet of a mother who smiles as she sings. In spite of myself, the insidious mastery of song betrays me back, till the heart of me weeps to belong to the old Sunday evenings at home, with winter outside, and hymns in the cosy parlour, the tinkling piano our guide. So now it is vain for the singer to burst into clamour with the great black piano appassionato. The glamour of childish days is upon me. My manhood is cast down in the flood of remembrance. I weep like a child for the past.